Well, welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 6. Before we begin, we must never forget that we live and work on Shkreplanmu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Squepnik people. It's obvious that doing everything we can to resolve the situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today we have three core representatives of the Shuswap Food Action Society, the SFAS, and they are in our studio to share with us what the society has been doing for the last year, tell us about some of the projects in the future, and help us understand the influence that the organization is gaining in the community and in the region with respect to our relationship with food, its availability, its quality, and its sustainability. Now, in alphabetical order, the Shuswap Food Action Society is capably represented today by Melanie Bennett, Projects Coordinator, Howie McMillan, Acting Manager of the Salmon Arm Downtown Farmers Market, and Mary Nichols, Coordinator of the School Food Program. To all of you, a warm welcome to Food Conversations.
Good morning.
Good morning, Warren.
Good morning.
There, you heard three different voices today, and we're delighted to have all three of you in the studio. And I would say thank heavens that we've completed all the renovations in the studio, because if it wasn't so, there's now room for all three of you to sit comfortably in our studio instead of being crowded and piled up on boxes and bins and stored equipment. So we...
This is the first time I've been in studio.
Tell our dear listeners, does it look a little neater and tidier in here?
It looks wonderful.
Thank you. That was a small advertisement from one of our guests. Excellent. So after that stunning revelation, Melanie, why don't we begin with you today as the projects coordinator and, to be honest, the longest serving member of the Food Action Society in the room today.
Right.
Yes, I know there are others, but... now, you just had the pleasant experience of a few days ago of a successful and fully subscribed community potluck supper. Filled the hall to capacity. Why don't you talk about the atmosphere of that, what undoubtedly was a bit of a joyous event?
Yeah, we were humbled, really, by the response. It was 4 years ago that we actually had a potluck in the same hall. And that was to support Food Action Society at the time. We did the same thing. We did a book exchange. So 4 years that we've done that holiday potluck. And we, you know, being advocates for local food, we decided we would purchase local pastured turkey. We brought in Keenan Family Farms ham and then asked our guests, of course, to provide the trimmings. We're humbled by how many people did come. And I think what we all really recognized was the variety of people coming. Not only people who are longstanding members or past board members, or current board members, families, children, you know, elders, but also a lot of newcomers and people who are interested in food sustainability, in learning more. So we were just really grateful to see such a wide variety of people.
And there's something quite special about people sitting down and, as they say, breaking bread together. It
yes.
brings out the best in people.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it was everything that I've heard so far. Everybody just absolutely loved the meal. And we will, you know, it's always been our goal to have even monthly potlucks, and we'll get there. It just, you know, the pandemic, of course, made everything come to a screeching halt. And then it just takes a little while to kind of get your bearings again.
And so does the Food Action Society give a few speeches?
We gave minimal speeches. It was not a time for speeches. It was meant for gathering, not necessarily presenting. Mm-hmm. But we did, and I'm thankful that Serena was able to, you know, a part of the reason for having this potluck was actually to acknowledge John McLeod, you know, past acting president, local food champion. We wanted to acknowledge him. He would have loved to have seen that gathering around food with the emphasis on local food. And also we had that book exchange because John was an avid reader. He, you know, he loved knowledge. He constantly was trying to acquire knowledge, and he's going to be really missed in this community.
Yeah, I echo your sentiments. John was not just a pillar of the Food Action Society, but really a dedicated citizen of this town and region. I still have in my phone the notice of when Lois called me to say he passed away sort of carried around with me to remind me what a lovely guy he was. Another successful and ongoing project of the Food Action Society is the Downtown Farmers Market, which you coordinate, Howie. And for the first time, it's taking place weekly throughout the winter, which is an interesting venture. Mother Nature doesn't always supply the weather that we hope she will. But on the other hand, has it changed the sort of dynamics of the market that now people know it's there every week?
I think that's a major contributing factor and probably the primary motivation. This is our fifth season with the market, and this is just starting our third winter season market and a year-round market. And what we're getting in by the way of feedback is that continuity and that reliability is really a factor in people coming out. They know that if it's Saturday morning, there's a market in downtown Salmon Arm, and that really helps.
You took the words right out of mouth, Howie. Has it changed the mix of vendors?
A bit. Again, the winter market is restricted in space. We don't have the closure of the Hudson Avenue that we do in the summer. So we restrict that market to food and drink vendors, with the exception of the holiday market that is in early December, where again we close a street and we had somewhere around 45 vendors at that time. In the winter, we're down to around 20 vendors, and primarily food. But it essentially, for them, it's that essence that, you know, for instance, if you want to buy your eggs there now, you can rely on getting your eggs there. You don't have to deal with those issues.
And you can rely on a little music once in a while, including, not so much right now, but at the beginning, an all-tuba band.
Yeah.
My first all-tuba band experience. Myself.
It's our second, actually. They were there last year for the holiday market as well. It's an amazing local phenomenon, but yeah, they performed at the holiday market on the 2nd of December and extremely well received. It is kind of amazing what they can crank out with nothing but tubas.
Exactly. I didn't know there were so many different sizes of tubas. Well, I sort of did know, but I'd never heard them all play together. One quick question so that our audience knows. How long is your Saturday on the day of the market?
It varies, but it's long. Summertime, I start about 6:30, and I'm out of there by about 2:30. Wintertime, 8-ish to, again, 2 o'clock, something like that. But it's, to me, it's a social outing, and it's not work, per se. It's kind of often the highlight of my week, so I'm not complaining about the hours, that's for sure.
Stealing the microphone to acknowledge the fact that Howie does this as a volunteer as well, because he's passionate about local food security and he really appreciates this project.
There you are. We have a brief advertisement from within the crowd here today. Now, Mary, you're coordinating the school meals program. You've gone from being a volunteer director of the society, now you're a staff person, which I think is an indication of what's actually going on in this area. It's a rapidly evolving field in this community and around the province, but you actually roll up your sleeves and do some cooking as well. If I recall correctly, it's at the Zest, and you have co-workers. So how many people are now actively involved in preparing the food that goes out to the schools or is in the schools?
Well, for the school meal program that we offer, we actually are in 21 different schools, and that does include the college as well. And we also serve to lunch with friends. So out of those 21, there's 3 cooks that are actually in the schools and preparing the meals on site. And then there's 3 of us that work at the Zest Food Hub, as you were saying. And we coordinate with... We've been really lucky lately, actually. We probably have about 10 volunteers coming in a week to help us prep the food, which has been amazing. So we're there 3 days a week. Tuesday's our big day where we're prepping everything, and that's when we have the most volunteers. And honestly, it's a lot of fun. We have people that are new to the area. There's people that are retired and looking for something to do, and it is a really great social gathering for us. So within a short period of time, we start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and often by 10 to 10:30, depending on the school schedule, we have to have all of the food ready and out the door.
And quickly, so it gets where it's supposed to go and is still hot off the griddle, as it were.
Exactly, yeah. So we focus on doing soups there, and we, like you said, we have a long ways to go. Like, we do deliver school to schools in Armstrong. We go to Lenwood, Silver Creek, lots of different areas. So it is quite a driving distance to get there.
And, you know, one illustration of how this program is doing is that on the website it says 18 schools. So between when the website was last updated and now, three more schools have been added. So,
well, and I guess that's due to the fact, too, the Super Meals program specifically is 18 schools, like you said, and then the three other schools that we're in, they're able to offer more than soup since they're on site and not having to worry about transporting as much.
It's really quite a buzz, this program, it seems to me. Now, we're going back a little bit to look at something that has become sort of the underpinning of the whole work schedule of the Food Action Society, and that's the annual fundraising drive, which takes place under the banner of the Coldest Night of the Year, which is a project of the Blue Sea Foundation, a Canadian charity based in Kitchener, Ontario, although it's across the country, it's now expanded into the States. It's officially described, and this is right off the website, as a winterific. That's a mashup of winter and terrific, ladies and gentlemen. Winterific family-friendly walk to raise money for local charities serving people experiencing hurt, hunger, and hopelessness.
Homelessness
rather. Which probably makes them feel hopeless too sometimes. How does the Salmon Arm project fit into that basic theme? It's obviously different for every community. Melanie.
Yeah, it's incredible because it's in 180 cities across Canada who all get together on this same night to get out there and walk. But so it's a national event, and yet it has its local flair and its local capacity, right? So for us, this is now, we're going into our fourth year hosting this. And, you know, we continue to be so thankful that, you know, in 2020, they reached out to us. At the time, you know, this has actually been in Salmon Arm for quite a few years, and other charities have hosted it in the past. But at the time, there wasn't a charity to host it in 2020. And so it came to us. They approached us to ask if we would be willing. And for us, we were thrilled. It was challenging because this was a big venture. We were still pretty small. We were just doing free soup on Fridays.
So, Melanie, what is the unique slant that is sort of theme, our take on the theme of...
Yeah, so, you know, in the 180 cities, multiple different kinds of charities do host this. It can be food banks, it can be community kitchens, it can be shelters, it can be mental health associations. So it's a great variety of charities who host this. And, you know, from its origins, which very much were around homelessness, it has grown to also then have the hurt, the hungry, and the homelessness. And in our situation here in Salmon Arm and in the Shoe Swap, our focus, of course, is the hungry. Like, we want people nourished, not just fed, but nourished with, like, truly fresh local food. We also appreciate the hurt. You know, our organization and our projects are meant to encourage people to get involved. We have an outlet, a variety of different kinds of things that people can do to be involved, and that gives you a sense of belonging. The homelessness, we have a small impact on direct homelessness, but we really, like other organizations, especially the other food banks, we focus on the folks who are near homelessness. And I think we don't, as a community, realize just how many people are on the verge. One small missed bill, one injury, one lost job. People are really struggling to pay their bills and also to buy food.
I would comment at this point that Patty Thurston at the Shoe Shop Family Center has suggested that there are probably about 400 people living either out rough, as they say, or somehow unhoused. It's a far larger number than most of us are comfortable admitting.
Yes.
And I think that's something that really needs to be borne in mind. The whole process, the Coldest Night of the Year, the Blue Sea Foundation, It started up in about 2011, and its first year it raised $111,000. Last year, it raised over $13 million. And in total, in the last 12 years, it's raised just under $100 million. It's been a remarkably successful And I would call it successful, but also it's a sign of something. And it works in all over the country in 166 different communities. And it suggests that there's an imbalance in our society. We're kind of off kilter a little bit by having to have something like this take on such an enormous job.
Yeah, I think people don't really realize what is happening outside their door, but they do want to give. We have a really generous community. There's a lot of different fundraisers. I would also like to say that I love this fundraiser in particular because it is really welcoming to everyone. You know, there's a lot of fundraisers that will happen that are galas or, you know, they have a fairly hefty ticket price.
Or a narrow focus.
And a narrow focus. And this is really, everyone is welcome to participate in this event. And you don't have to fundraise, but this is a fundraiser for our society. But everyone is welcome to come and participate.
I'd remind listeners once again that we have three guests in the studio today. Melanie Bennett, who you just heard, who's the projects coordinator for the Shuswap Food Action Society. Howie McMillan, who's the acting manager of the Salmon Arm Downtown Farmers Market. And Mary Nichols Rodriguez, who's the coordinator of the school food program. Why don't you give us, Melanie, a little précis of the stone soup story, because it's a story that kind of underlies the whole process of
it definitely brings about all the different components of, you know, what a community can do together, how each person has something that they can contribute. So if you're taking the story of stone soup, you know, each household in this village, they felt like they had very little, but by, you know, strangers coming into the village and saying, I'd like to make some stone soup. Do you have a pot? Do you have stones? Do you have a carrot? Do you have an onion? And all of the villagers coming together to say, yes, I can add this one thing to the whole to make something even better. And so last year, actually, it's been 2 years now. In 2022, we offered the stone soup story as a part of our campaign. Mm-hmm. We then made a stone soup for that final meal when walkers came and they did their 2 or 5 kilometer walks. They came back to Askew's and they had stone soup and we all had it together. Then we also offered it to our PACs, so our PACs at the schools. We gave them the ingredients, we gave them the recipe, the storyline. Teachers were encouraged to share it with their students, and they made stone soup at their schools as a way to acknowledge that same idea that they are a community.
So I found the full story on the website of the Canadian Food Grains Bank, which is a volunteer organization that tries to assure food security in various parts of the country and elsewhere. And here's the last two paragraphs from the story. It's quite charming. When the soup was finally done, the old man, who is the person who came into the town and dropped the little stone into the soup pot to start the process, the old man ladled it out into bowls, and they all shared a delicious meal together. It was more than enough for everyone to eat their fill. And afterward, they all declared that it was the best soup they had ever tasted. The mayor of the village pulled the old man aside and quietly offered him a great deal of money for the magic stone that had started it all off, but the old man refused to sell it. The next morning, he woke early and packed up his belongings. As he was leaving the village, he passed by a group of children playing at the side of the road. He handed the youngest one the silk pouch containing the stone, and he whispered, "It was not the stone that performed the magic. It was all of us together." Now, that's a very eloquent story.
Yeah, and it's true. The sentiment this year, you know, after everything with the fires, is that we are stronger together. And, you know, a lot of our projects, whether it's the community garden, even 20 minutes from someone does a lot of work. The volunteers that come to the kitchens to help us with the school meals, that they have no idea how helpful that is. Hmm. Everyone who comes to the farmer's market and even spends $5, it adds, it contributes to the whole.
I would interject here also the role that volunteerism plays in this community and really every community. If we took away volunteers, you mentioned Howie doing what he does, but I'm sure there are times at 6:30 in the morning, Howie, you could probably have another snooze for maybe 5 more minutes if you thought it was an option. But volunteers really do an extraordinary amount of the work that's going on here. Now, Mary, you're in the middle of a process that's in great flux, and that is the school program, not just locally, but around BC. You comment before we went on air, you commented about how much work Serena Kaner, who's the former president of Shuswap Food Action Society, had done. And there's also been a quantum leap forward because the provincial government has become involved. And Serena is now working for the Provincial Feeding Futures Program, which is the initiative that was announced on April the 4th of this year, where $214 million over a three-year period would be put into really advancing the whole program of school food. How did that announcement impact just the whole field of, if you want to call it, food going to school children and now the college as well? How did that impact that announcement?
Well, I mean, it does allow room now for the program to grow quite a bit because there's a lot more schools that are able to access this funding and supporting the schools. One of the big things with this program is that they're really trying to make it a universal program and reduce stigma around food, which is so important.
It's a really central issue.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I was able to sit in on a round table and they had different people who within the community who had needed support in the past or maybe were needing support accessing food services. And they were just talking about how much that really meant and, you know, kids being told in the past, for example, that they couldn't have a snack or not even feeling like they were able to send their kids to school because they didn't have something to send with their kids. You know, that's something that a lot of us haven't had to really consider. And it makes a huge, huge difference to then have food available to anybody at the school, regardless of their income. You know, they can have it even if they do have a lunch, they can have it if they don't have a lunch, and often schools are even able to send a little bit home with students that are needing something extra at home as well.
Now, you mentioned that there's a number of people, you have volunteers, 10 to a dozen volunteers, and you have, I believe, 6 actual people working sort of full-time. What's it like? I mean, this is a big operation. This is like feeding an army, or an army of young people with voracious appetites. Is it a scramble when you get up in the morning and start going? Is it hair straight back sort of thing?
Well, I mean, we don't necessarily all work together and not all on the same day. So there are some schools that offer programs once a week. Jackson, they're able to offer programs 4 days a week. And at SMS, they offer programs 3 days a week. And then for us at Zest, we're cooking 3 days a week as well. So there's definitely a lot of coordination that goes into everything to make it a success and to get soup to school in time. And, you know, that presents a challenge, but it's also a lot of fun.
And each school has somewhat different facilities, somewhat different priorities. And so you're adjusting to each school's way of implementing this school food program. What's that like? You must be keeping a lot of notes somewhere.
I actually have 2 binders.
Two binders.
Serena, once again, was amazing in creating a lot of different charts just to coordinate it. And, you know, even the consideration onto which schools you're able to make it on which days, depending on how far you're having to travel and which direction.
And some schools don't have any food facilities at all, and others have quite advanced.
Yeah,
food.
There's some that don't have refrigerators that they can use right now or don't have a dishwasher, for example. So definitely a lot of challenges, and that's where it's been really great to be able to work with the school boards to try to get some of that infrastructure in place. You know, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's definitely shifting in the right direction, which is amazing.
And one of the emphases in this part of the world is to try and get local food. And that's been a theme with the Shuswap Food Action Society from the very beginning. That must add another layer of complexity, logistics to what you're doing, having to track it down and bring it in and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really fortunate in that I have been able to connect with farmers. And Serena, once again, was also able to develop a lot of relationships with farmers so that now, you know, a lot of them are stored in my phone or they're just a click away from an email and just contacting people, see what they have available. Because I also work at a farm myself, I kind of know certain things that are in season right now, which is helpful. Mm-hmm. And then just, yeah, contacting different people. Sometimes they contact me and say, you know, I have X amount of carrots available this week. Can you use them? So once again, that's like that really amazing community building piece and getting to know your neighbors. And it's been one of the really rewarding parts of this job.
This is like the stone soup story writ a little bit larger and broader and involving more people. Now, you also have to have a menu. And I understand it's laid out a little bit in advance for people to see what's coming. How did that work out, that process of a menu preparation for all these different places? It sounds like a big scramble to me.
Well, that is also amazing. I mean, being involved in Shuswap Food Action, I think a lot of us came together as well because of our love of food and loving to cook and enjoy local food and try new recipes because of that. So we do have a bunch of like school favorites. You know, chicken noodle is always a big one for kids. We have another one that's been a winner in the last little while, which is a potato corn bacon soup. That one's also been sort of a crowd pleaser. So we're able to keep those ones in that we know the kids really enjoy, especially when schools are first coming on board, just so that they see sort of the enjoyment of the students and the staff. And then from there, we kind of, you know, throw in a bunch of new mixes just to try new things. Some of those are recipes from different cultures. They might be like favorites from other people's homes that they've tried and are successful. So yeah, also a lot of fun actually incorporating all those recipes.
I have a feeling that there is a cookbook being prepared in the ether somewhere. It sounds like it. Super meals. I saw that phrase, super meals, spelled S-O-U-P-E-R. It's one part of this whole program, the soup part.
Yeah, absolutely. That was like kind of a, once again, like a big part of Serena and just being able to engage kids and of all ages and getting them excited about trying something that might be new for them.
So Mary, I just wanted to get a sense of the logistics of a day when you're involved with the program. When does it start? Where do you go? What do you do? You know, just so people have an idea. It's a very busy time.
Yeah, so I would say that usually around 7:30 in the morning, I head over to Inspired Breads and I pick up from Marcus and Ursula, who are making our buns for us, which everyone in the school loves. You know, some schools you're honestly having to like bat people off with your tongs because they're trying to have a third bun. So that's a lot of fun. So I'll pick up from them in the morning and then I'll take the bread down to the Zest Food Hub. As you can imagine, with all the vegetables and meat we get from local farmers, my car is sometimes literally packed from the floor to the ceiling. And so we'll go down there and just start unloading everything. Hiromi and Gulistan will meet me down at Zest and we will just start unloading everything. And that's usually when our volunteers start to show up. So Zest Food Hub has recently got a large reefer outdoor refrigerator, which is amazing for our program.
Yeah, that's been a big advantage.
Oh, for sure. So we will, you know, they have carts there and we literally are just offloading things from the reefer and from my vehicle and taking them inside. We usually start by cleaning and sanitizing all of the Cambros, which is a very large thermos that fits about 350 to 400. That's in total. I shouldn't say that. So about 50 to 60 per Cambro. And so we wash and sterilize all that. And simultaneously, people are washing vegetables, have all the peelers out, have all the knives out. You know, the soup steam kettles are raging and everything sort of happens simultaneously.
I'm sure our listeners are having a bit of a visual of a maelstrom of activity. And I'm sure that's a very accurate one. I should mention, by the way, on the side, you as light entertainment, you work at Wildflight Farm and come out every couple of weeks now, of course, to be at the market. How much time do you put in at Wildflight?
In the summertime, it's a full-time position. Like you mentioned, in the winter, because the markets are every second week and I'm just running the markets, it's, you know, about 40, 50 hours a month. So it's not as heavy in the wintertime for sure, which is great because it allows me to do all the stuff with the soup.
Anybody who thinks you're not busy, I think they'll be disabused of that illusion. Howie, now you oversee a process, the Downtown Farmers Market, that is one of the most visible parts of what the Shuswap Food Action Society supports. It's focused also around local food producers and vendors. It's also kind of a celebratory, you mentioned earlier, kind of a social event, a celebratory space to be in. What's the atmosphere like on a typical market day? It seems pretty busy to me.
It's busy, but it's an ambiance that many of the vendors suggest that it's kind of, you know, their social outing as well. The old premise of know your farmer. really resonates at a market like ours simply because of that interreaction. It really, I think, strengthens the whole connection to food. I would argue that it adds to the value of the food when you know on a first name basis who you're getting that food from in that sense.
Now, you made a point just a moment ago that farmers are getting to hang out with other farmers. Now, I've talked, John McLeod, we talked about earlier, and he would often say, you know, farmers are, you know, they live in their own farm, and they don't want to have anything to do with anybody else, which, of course, isn't really true. But at the market, they also get together. And I see some, you know, Jennifer Wesley wandering around from place to place, time to time. It's something that is a little unique for them. They actually come together in parallel. They're not really competing with one another. They're just kind of working in parallel.
It is. And another interesting dynamic of that is they shop from each other.
Yeah.
They essentially do a lot of their sourcing of groceries from the other vendors at the market. It's a fascinating dynamic in the sense that it is a family-like environment, and the patrons of the market pick up on that. Interestingly, for instance, we had an economic impact study done last summer from the BC Farmers Market Association, and one of the questions in the survey that was completed was the primary reason you came to the market, and of course, fresh vegetables and bread and all those things were first and second in that. But the third highest answer to your primary reason to coming to the market was the social atmosphere, the connection with your neighbors and with your food suppliers and that type of thing. And it is a dynamic that really defines a farmer's market in my mind. Is it is a coming together of community. And again, our mission to build community around local food is so epitomized by the atmosphere in our market.
And it's such an ancient process. I mean, economists talk about the market, but this is the real market. This is the market the way it's always been, with vendors working in parallel they're not trying to drive somebody else out of their market share. They're simply offering what they have. I think that must contribute to it as well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's certainly a big part of what makes a market work is that shared passion for food and providing that food to our community.
And the sharing extends even further, because in this survey, there was an attempt made to calculate the so-called multiplier effect, the impact that the market has on other aspects of the downtown and the community in general. Why don't you lay out some of the if not the numbers, at least the gist of what that's all about?
Yeah, it was an interesting dynamic. I mean, I'm at the market every week and have been for, you know, 4 years now, certainly 3 years helping out. So it's always kind of hard to gauge or quantify what it is. But this impact study really was an eye-opener for us. Their calculations and their estimates suggested that over the course of the year, roughly 68,000 visitors came to the downtown market. And the economic impact of that, in addition to the social and atmospheres, is pretty profound. It's a multi-million dollar impact on the economy. And as you say, a multiplier effect. There were two components that they identified. One, the money spent at the farmers market, but how that contributed in a multiplier effect around the community, because all of those farmers and producers and bakers, they are sourcing from other places, buying fuel and buying inputs and all those types of things. And then one of the questions in the survey specifically asked the participants, and there were over 230 people responded, whether they shopped anywhere else downtown when they were at the market. And 92% of them said, yes, they did. And they asked them how much, and they extrapolated that. And they suggested that it was north of $3 million spent in the downtown area as a direct response to those people coming to the market and then shopping around downtown during their visit to the downtown area.
You know, it's enlivening and kind of sobering to see that one aspect of what goes on in a community influences other aspects. And this is a process where people come to get something that they need, to get something that they enjoy, and then they kind of transpose that sentiment to their engagement with the community at large. It makes me feel good, and I'm sure it makes all of you feel good as well.
Yeah, I think it does. And again, it's not just the market. If we talk about that economic concept of a multiplier effect, Mary and the school meals are sourcing most of that food from local farmers. We have a family box program that I participated in yesterday where food insecure households are, through the school district, funded with a box that goes out to about 60 households. Over the last 3 years, that program has pumped in excess of $225,000 into the local economy. Mm-hmm. But because of its focus on local food, roughly 80% of that went into the pockets of local farmers. And yeah. If you take that multiplier effect and compound it all the way out, again, the impact is huge.
And so many businesses and food businesses, I would put into that category, have survived by bringing food from far away, dropping it off in some town like Salmon Arm, and then all of the sales, the money from sales, goes shooting out of the community as well. It doesn't stay here. Mm-hmm. And it really is a situation that we've talked about many times in this show about changing the food system. And the change is towards locally produced, fresh, available, healthy food. And it's something that it's coming. It's coming in steps all the time and getting stronger all the time. But what you've just described is a key element in bringing that about. Now, Mary, you're bringing food, local food, to kids. And kids are seeing healthy local food presented to them in an educational setting. It's probably the nicest thing that happens to them sometimes in the day in school. And it's... Do you have a sense of that? Do you have a sense of that as you're, you know, bringing your vehicle piled high with food and you're frantically getting it all ready and distributing it out to the schools? Do you have a sense of the fact that you're actually educating? I mean, it's not formal education, but you're actually educating in a very concrete way a whole generation of young people to understand that really nice food can be part of a daily experience, and it's just built in. It's part of what happens.
I think dropping off, like one of the areas we're actually looking for more volunteers for, hint, hint, listeners, is to
have... You heard it first on your channel.
is to have people come into the schools and help us serve the soups. And that's honestly such a rewarding experience because you're in the hallways, you're literally serving the soup to kids. Kids are getting excited. Kids that maybe haven't tried soup before are coming back for seconds or are asking for another scoop. And sometimes you even have teachers that are coming up to you that are just astounded that, you know, little so-and-so is trying soup for, like, coming back for a second bowl of soup because normally they don't eat vegetables, for example. So absolutely, that's
really...
And
their parents are probably thinking when they come home and say, we have this really nice something or other, and they say, you never ate that at home before.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I even find that in my household, which is funny. But, you know, we'll often get comments on our Facebook page, for example, of parents saying that their kids love the recipe and could they have the recipe to try at home. And we love doing that. We've shared it with different daycares as well who have asked for recipes. And once again, back to that community building and not trying to keep something to yourself, but just excitedly sharing it with others so that they can... Yeah, try it at home and cook with their family. Like, how amazing is that?
Can't get much more amazing than that. Remind listeners again that we have in the studio today, and we're speaking with Melanie Bennett, Howie McMillan, and Mary Nichols Rodriguez from the Sioux Shop Food Action Society. Now, the society's been on the ground for a number of years. Melanie, it's got a lot of irons and a lot of fires, if you want to put it that way. I hope they're not burning out of control. You never use the word fire around this part of the country without getting a little nervous. Why don't we talk about some of the other things? Because there are other things ongoing. For example, the Fall Fair Lecture Series, which is an annual, now becoming an annual event, and was really and increasingly well attended this year as opposed to the year before. Why don't you talk about that was. Jim McEwen at the fair saying, you know, being very supportive of.
Yeah, Jim and Buckerfield. Toni Walton. I'll always give her lots of credit because yes. She's an advocate for local food as well. We're really thankful to the Fall Fair and the Salmon Arm Shuswap Lake Agricultural Association.
You got it right.
You know, Jim is also, he's a driver. Like, he really is interested in building the agricultural component of the fair. Like, you know, he wants to do different things. And so he's approached us with ideas. And, you know, thankfully it fits and it works with our ethics as well. And we're able to do it. And so we're always really grateful to, you know, other community members who come to us with ideas. And then we can work together to do it. So, you know, we're also so, so thankful to all of the people who continue to give their time to educate, you know, all the people who came to do the urban agriculture series the first year. And then last year we sort of changed it to food security series. They come and they do it for free. They come and they give their time and they travel in and they stand on stage. And it's not always comfortable for people. And they give their time for free. And that's the same even with the Sunday sessions that we're doing at Buckerfields, where we're doing it every Sunday from 2 to 3. You know, educators are coming in to share knowledge, and that's because they're really passionate about it, and we really appreciate them.
One specific project that Jim has been very involved in is Project Grow. Why don't you describe that? That's a wonderful kind of tying to what Mary's been doing in the school system. This is another thing that also brings young people into the food world.
Yeah, in conversation, you know, I'm can't quite remember even where, like, we talked about this idea of creating this sort of like umbrella-like project, Project Grow. Mm-hmm. And it actually, it stemmed more from a youth garden contest that was happening in Summerland at their fall fair. And then it just became this idea like, okay, well, we could actually have this as the main program that we would then have multiple projects under. And so Project Grow is meant to be this sort of like the central hub of a wheel. And there would be multiple things that would come off of it. So in one case, it would be Project Grow Food Security Series, Project Grow Youth Garden Contest. I'd love to see a general, like the Green Thumb Project come back, where people actually transform their yards. So there's multiple things that we could do. And that's always the big thing. We have so many ideas. We have so many things we would love to do.
Yes, the Shuswap Climate Action Society has an initiative called it's not Ditch
Rewilding.
The Lawn.
Yeah, Ditch the Lawn.
Yeah, it's the idea that you turn your yard into a garden growing food and
pollinator friendly and
all sorts of things that are available. I mean, they're available, but there are also things that we can adopt because other people have done it. They've been very successful. We're not having to reinvent the wheel. Speaking of another learning experience, and that's the teaching garden. The teaching garden seems to be going...
It's going amazing.
Yeah.
And that's because, again, of, you know, key volunteers who continue to, you know, care deeply about it. We're really thankful to Sue Moore, who's a, you know, organic farmer, selling her farm, but still yet, you know, you can't help but keep your hands in
the
soil.
She has dirt under her nails all
absolutely
the time.
And and Elmarie Roberts, and she's been on the show before too.
Indeed.
But I mean, we have multiple volunteers. I'd like to acknowledge Nan Gray as well. She also helps with our volunteer coordinators, and, you know, Rita Greger. So there's so many names I could list, but, you know, their key contribution is to see that garden become very productive. So as a farmer, Sue comes at it and she looks at it like, how do we maximize production? Elmarie comes at it through a permacultural lens, and she's looking at it, how do we create a beautiful oasis? How do we incorporate, you know, multiple functions, the pollinators, learning, building, and also really we want to see kids up there. And it's been really gratifying to see students coming up with different classes. It could be kindergarten students, it can be all the way up to, it can be high school, coming there and learning hands-on what it's like. And seeing their joy of, you know, growing food or pulling carrots, tasting the scarlet runner beans this year, tasting that fresh parsley, like, it's very, very rewarding.
Okay, quick quiz. Who among the three of you has had a garden when you were, or grown food when you were a kid? Anybody? Put hands up and I'll tell them how many hands are up.
I didn't.
Yes, you were too busy being a wedding planner.
No, I was busy moving every single year as a kid. But my grandma always had a garden. My grandpa always had a garden too.
Isn't it a marvelous thing, though, how growing food when you're young and you put the seeds in the ground, or you put the saplings and the little, you know, sprouts in the ground, and then you see them come up. It's
miraculous.
It's an astonishing thing.
It is. We want to focus on kids, really, with everything that we do. If we can if we can teach them how to grow food and to see that miraculous component of a seed sprouting, if we could have kids and families coming down to the farmer's market and feeling that vibe and that energy of being there, if we can have kids trying food at schools, that is the way forward. And that's where our focus needs to lie, because we need to change the trajectory of our food system and food culture.
Now, there was a specific project that is only indirectly related to food, but it was something that was a big deal in terms of what the Shuswap Food Action Society, and that was working on a project to raise money for wildfire victims, because that was a big deal this year. I believe the United Way was the coordinating body. Howie, why don't you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, it was part of the wildfire relief effort, and United Way was certainly the agency that spearheaded that. Shuswap Food Action was invited, and we were able to participate in a small way at least. We applied and received a grant to assist those people, and working with the local ESS group, we were able to distribute a fair chunk of assistance to a lot of the most severe victims of the fire. And interestingly, we were able to keep a food focus on that. Most of those funds went out into shoebox food coupons that were redeemable at the farmers market, and downtown dollars that were redeemable at local restaurants and groceries, outlets, and that type of thing. So it was another great example of how our food-centric focus can really make a difference in the community, good times and in bad. We were very pleased to participate in that.
Why don't we just elaborate a little bit on the shoebox, which is spelt, by the way, dear listeners, S-H-U-B-O-X. It's been going for a while, Melanie, and Howie is a principal involved with it. Describe just the basic mechanism, how it works.
It's based largely on a provincial program called the BC Nutrition Coupon Program that was administered by the Association of Farmers Markets and is distributed through about 145 markets around the province. It's funded by the Ministry of Health and goes out to struggling or food insecure households and with a bent on improving nutrition in some of those households. It's a great program. It's a series of coupons that goes out to the recipients. They get essentially a sheet of coupons every week for 16 weeks. What I did with our shoebox program is the recognition that if you're food insecure, you're not just food insecure for 16 weeks of the year. It's pretty much an annual deal. So we launched the shoebox food coupons about 2 years ago, and it is growing very rapidly with two primary objectives. One is to augment and support the existing nutrition coupon program, but the other is to reach out further into the community as a way for the community to participate in that food system at a local level. Essentially, what the food coupon does is gives that individual, the recipient, the currency, if you will. They're $3 vouchers that you can only spend at a participating farmers market throughout the Shuswap. So essentially, it keeps those dollars local. It keeps generating, and it goes back into that whole multiplier effect and all of those things. So it's a great program. We are currently in the process of expanding it, and we're hoping to add on to and raise funds to increase the impact for that program.
You know, what you're describing is something that a lot of people realize we need to do more of, and that is, broadly speaking, income redistribution. In other words, you take funds that are available from people who have excess or at least have adequate, and you distribute it back into the community. And it's something that has come up recently with respect to the Council of the Parties, COP28, in, of all places, a major oil-producing country, the United Arab Emirates. And there was a major article in the Guardian, the newspaper, about how very wealthy people are both consuming incredible amounts of goods and services, but also contributing to the climate problem by their lavish lifestyle. And if we kind of rebalance society and some of that expenditure and lavishness went to the millions and, in fact, billions of people who are not so fortunate, we'd have a much healthier human species and a much better planetary configuration, you might say. Mary, I wanted to give the last word to you because you had an experience that I think is quite relevant to what people are dealing with here, and that is you worked for a while in Hay River, a little town of about 3,000 on the south shore of Great Slave Lake, about half indigenous, interestingly, the half the population total is indigenous. And you worked on a nonprofit farm, but you were working in a community where food security, compared to what it's like in this part of the world, is astonishingly fragile. Maybe you could just compare and contrast Hay River and Salmon Arm and what the life is between the two communities.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many differences. It's hard to cover in a short period of time for sure. But I would say that one of the amazing things about being in Hay River is really something that we're building here as well, and just the community aspect of it. You know, when there is a occurrence, for example, we had one of the times we were there, a flood, a road, the only road coming in and out of the territories got washed out. And there's no trucks that can come in and out, and just being able to see how communities are willing to pull together and work together in order to make sure that everyone does have access to whatever they need. I was fortunate enough that I lived on a street and we were all growing and raising our own food and had freezers full. And honestly, I think with what we had in storage, we probably could have, you know, fed neighbors blocks on either side, just from what we were able to grow and produce on our own. But, you know, the culture is very different as well. Like in Dene culture, it is very common that everybody shares. You know, a hunter goes out, they get something, they share it with the community.
Absolutely.
It's not something that's kept to yourself. Like everything that is given to you is redistributed. And those values are really important, you know, then, and like they've been for a time immemorial. So that was a wonderful aspect too.
And were you seeing or sensing that the community at large was aware of this way of living and how important it is for us to start thinking that way, as opposed to thinking about every person gathering for themselves and not caring about what other people are going through?
Yeah, I mean, it's always something that people are striving for, right? It's never perfect. On the Kedlodiche First Nations, where we had a lot of really great friends, and a lot of the elders that we got the opportunity to get to know there, that's something that is always brought up and is always remembered from childhood, and something that I think they're continuing to foster. And, you know, there is my husband worked at the Kedlodiche First Nations as well, and they had a community freezer, for example, there. And when hunters went out, if they had excess or, you know, part of what they had went into the freezer, and any community member could access it. So, I mean, nothing's ever perfect. It's always something we're striving for. But, yeah, it was an amazing experience for sure.
Mel.
Yeah, I just wanted that sharing concept as opposed to taking anything from anyone. It's about sharing and encouraging people to share. I also want to thank the two of you for sharing your time. People may not know that the Shuswap Food Conversation started actually, it's a Shuswap Food Action Project started by Shelley Corbin and Ron Boer. And it was at the Okanagan College. And through your time and interests, you have maintained it on the voice of the Shuswap Radio. And we really appreciate everything that you're doing as well.
And no money was transferred from hand to hand to introduce that
little
speech.
You are sharing your time and skill.
Well, I think this is a wonderful note to end on, because it is a transformative process that I think the whole human community has to go through. We have to learn that sharing is the essential principle for not just survival, but our peace
of
mind. Yes, our souls. We've been delighted to have three, as I said, core members of the Shuswap Food Action Society with us today. Melanie Bennett, who is officially the project manager and does all sorts of other stuff as well. Howie McMillan, who is officially the acting manager of the Salmon Arm Downtown Farmers Market, but as you heard as well, has his finger in a number of other pies within the food action world. And Mary Nichols Rodriguez, who is the coordinator of the school food program and is giving a whole new generation of young people an opportunity to get excited about food and take their messages home to their families and spread the word. Thank you all for being here today. It's been wonderful to have you all in.
in our refurbished studio, and we'll be talking to all of you over time again, I'm sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to you both.
Thanks, Tom.
Happy holidays.